At 89, something shifts. Not gradually, but with startling clarity. You realize you've crossed an invisible border. You're no longer aging. You've arrived. Diana Athel, the legendary editor who shaped some of the 20th century's greatest writers, turned her unflinching gaze inward and discovered something unexpected. Old age, for all its losses, carries its own strange gifts. While most memoirs about aging either rage against the dying of the light or retreat into sentimental nostalgia, Athel does neither. She simply looks, really looks, at what remains when so much has fallen away. What she finds isn't despair or resignation, but something more surprising, a kind of lightness, even joy. The most startling loss? The end of her identity as a sexual being, something that had defined her for 7 decades. Sex wasn't just pleasure, it was identity, a fundamental way of moving through the world. From childhood engagements to devastating adult heartbreaks, desire shaped everything. At 15, she fell for Paul, imagining lifelong fidelity until his infidelity shattered her naivete. Decades of affairs with married men followed, never troubling her conscience. She developed radical skepticism about sexual exclusivity, believing it overvalued and destructive. The end came not with drama, but a whisper. After 8 years with Barry, physical interest faded into comfortable familiarity. She began faking pleasure, never discussing it. When he had an affair with a younger woman, she felt one night of grief. Not for betrayal, but for lost youth. 2 unexpected affairs extended her sexual life 7 more years, gifts she received with gratitude. Here's what's rarely acknowledged. Women's bodies are designed for reproduction in ways that make sex fundamentally different from men's experience. Many women disappear into their sexual identity during their physical peak, only discovering their true personalities in middle age. When desire recedes, other dimensions of self emerge with surprising clarity. At Oxford in the late 1930s, Duncan challenged her assumption that some first cause must exist. Why? Might it not be that beginnings and endings are things we think in terms of simply because our minds are too primitive to conceive of anything else? Looking at stars scattered across the night sky, she felt dizzy elation, accepting this instantly as truth. How can human-conceived ideas be universally relevant when we occupy a cosmic speck and can't explain 90% of existence? Faith, deciding to act as though you believe something without reason, seems like elaborate self-deception. The universe continues regardless of our beliefs. Yet her moral compass comes entirely from Christian upbringing, doing unto others, turning the other cheek, helping those in trouble. She accepts Christ's teaching partly from childhood influence and partly because it continues making sense. Beyond ethics, she benefits from belief's artistic legacy. What moves her in religious art isn't technical skill, but selflessness, artists representing something outside themselves with utmost respect. Though indifferent to most religious writing, the Bible remains an exception. Her grandmother's gift for reading these stories left permanent impressions so deeply engraved they can't be erased by disbelief. As her mother reached 92, anxiety became physical, waking at night listening for movements, terrified by every cough. After a year splitting time between London and Norfolk, her blood pressure became dangerously high. She wrote a poem about white vans with painted-out windows that transport the dead, carrying junkies, frozen old women, suicides, stabbing victims. The handlers seem to carry a look of impatient ribaldry, as if despising those who don't understand death's utter ordinariness. When her mother finally died at nearly 96, she was fortunate. The day before her birthday, after planting a eucalyptus tree, she felt unsteady and was hospitalized with heart failure. When Athel arrived, her mother gave her a great flash of recognition and utmost joy, love she'd never doubted, flaming into visibility. The second day brought morphine-induced calm. Her final words before slipping into her last sleep were about a recent garden visit. It was absolutely divine. When Barry took his play to Jamaica, he found Sally Carey, a farmer's daughter from Somerset, willing to travel cheaply for the role. Back in England, Athil quickly understood why Barry loved her. Sally was one of the nicest people she'd ever met. When Sally struggled financially with infrequent acting work, Athil suggested she move in since she spent most nights with Barry anyway. Their ménage à trois seemed odd to others, but Athil wasn't possessively jealous. She simply enjoyed having a lovely new friend alongside her darling old one. Those 2 years were among her happiest. Eventually, Sally married Henry Bagginal and took over her father's farm, and their children became like grandchildren to Athil. Young people provide invaluable counterbalance to an old person's tendency toward pessimism. They remind us we're not just dots at the end of thin black lines, but part of life's continuing river. The gift is in whatever companionship they generously offer, though one must be careful not to become addicted to their approval. We avoid dwelling on old age's difficulties, but Athil's time became consumed caring for people aging faster than herself. Eventually, most will either care or be cared for. While the former is preferable, she failed to grasp how unenjoyable it would be. Barry's diabetes worsened dramatically. Unlike most diabetics who manage well, he feels permanently exhausted and rarely leaves his bed. She feels guilty about not controlling his diet, but it's impossible. He refuses to eat properly and sneaks out to buy sweets. The worst part is watching his energy drain away, taking his interests with it. This intelligent man now reads only crime fiction, never finishing books. What keeps elderly spouses going through these motions of care? Obligations grown from love remain part of the same organism, becoming effortlessly binding despite being unwelcome. These roots have grown too deep to extract without destroying what remains. The best part of old age was discovering she could write. Unlike most writers who know early, she was surprised twice. First, when memories surfaced with pleasure, then discovering the delicious freedom of writing in her 80s. Freed from self-consciousness, she found a closet exhibitionist who loved making audiences laugh. The absence of regret about childlessness surprises her most. At 43, pregnancy awakened astonishing happiness until she miscarried in the fourth month, nearly dying. After the operation, vomiting from chloroform, an intense sensation swept through. I am still alive. This perfect joy swept away grief for the lost child. Alice Hurt's Summer, at 103, exemplifies built-in resilience. A brilliant pianist who survived Theresienstadt concentration camp, she returned to find her home emptied. After her son's sudden death at 65, she lives alone in London, radiantly joyful, playing piano 3 hours daily, choosing to look only for the good. She says, "Life is beautiful, extremely beautiful, and when you are old, you appreciate it more." A human life contains many opposites: serenity and turmoil, heartbreak and happiness. What dies is the worn-out container of the self, not a life's value. The tree fern now has 9 fronds. She was right she'd never see it become a tree, but underestimated the pleasure of watching it be a fern. That small joy of watching something grow, even as you diminish, might be the truest wisdom old age offers.